You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Squeaky Curd, a food show coming to you from CGLO, where we examine our relationship with food here in Montreal. I'm your host, Gwen Rowley. I'm a journalism grad student at Concordia, and I am not a food expert. I just like to eat. Today, we're going to look at how we interact with food trends on social media, how this affects our relationship with food IRL, and what kinds of communities are popping up online around food. IRL means in real life. So, a few months ago, I was mindlessly scrolling through my phone, as I have been doing nonstop for the past year, and I saw a video from TikTok where someone put a block of feta in a pan, surrounded it with cherry tomatoes, olive oil, basil, and salt and pepper, and then baked it before stirring cooked pasta into the melted, creamy cheese. I thought to myself, that looks good, and then continued to scroll. Then I saw another version of this recipe, and then another, and then another. My friends told me they made it for dinner a few nights later. And then I made it for dinner. And then I saw news stories about how some stores were selling out of feta because so many people were buying it to try out this recipe. This seems to happen a lot now. Social media affects our lives offline, and ever since the pandemic, with everyone being more plugged into their online networks, food trends seem to hold an even bigger place in our shared consciousness. Who among us in the past year hasn't at least tried the feta pasta, or whipped coffee, or fermenting your own sourdough starter? You'd have to be pretty offline to have not at least been aware of these trends. And food trends do not just appear for no reason. For a food trend to be successful, it needs to have visual appeal, seem a little fancy without requiring too much work. Most of the time, food trends also tend to be educational. And then the posts of that trend need to pass all of the specifications of a certain app's algorithm to make it to the top of people's feeds, to then be shared over and over again until the trend runs out of steam. To learn more about how this process works and how it has been impacted by the pandemic, I spoke with artist Daniela Silva, who is studying this very topic for her master's project at Concordia.
So my name is Daniela Silva. My pronouns are she and her. I am from Bogota, Colombia. I'm an artist and curator, and I am currently finishing up my master's in media studies, and I'm studying food accounts on Instagram, specifically food content during the past year. So I'm asking, what can we learn about the food landscape once we examine it through the vantage point of a global pandemic?
I asked Daniela why she feels like people get attracted to food trends, and here's what she had to say.
FOMO. Definitely. I mean, I think that social media sort of creates this fear of missing out, but also if you look at it psychologically, like it's human nature to want to be a part of something that's a bit bigger than you and wanting to participate. So I think that it really depends on the people who are participating. Like, are they people who just look at food content and love food content and want to share it? Or are they just following these, I don't know, visually aesthetic, like visually pleasing food and sort of texture blogs? And are they just in it for the fun? It really depends.
On top of the food trends I already talked about, she had some others to add to the list of things people have been posting online since the pandemic started.
I think the door is pretty wide open. Like, we've seen some crazy things, especially last year. I've seen some that like really blow my mind, like that everything is cake trend for me is insane. Like a toilet paper roll, and then it ends up being cake. And then the worst one that I saw was like the chicken breast being a cake. And I was like, this is no, there's so many. There's the pancake cereal. So you make tiny pancakes and then you put them in a bowl with milk. Just really, again, extra time. Like, why? And also, why would you want small pancakes? The bigger ones are so much better. But I really don't. Like, I really didn't get it, but I definitely think it's more like, oh, it just looks appealing, tiny things in a little bowl. I also saw donut cereal as well, and that also looked like a lot of work. Like, why would you fry tiny donuts and then sit down and eat 100 tiny donuts? I don't know. I also saw Cloud Red, which again, it's a great mix of like that visual appeal. It's like fluffy, you can dye it different colors, but it's healthy, apparently. Whoa. It's part of the keto diet. You make it with egg whites. So it really mixes, you know? It's like those two different it intersects into those two points.
The reasons why people get into so many wild food trends seem obvious. They're bored and they have a lot of time on their hands. So even if they're not participating in a food trend offline after they see it online, they still are more likely to interact with the content on their feeds than they were in pre-pandemic times. However, Daniela said that a lot of the time it is also a means of unplugging when you're spending too much time on your phone.
There's this, you know, there's this survival instinct that kicks in apparently. There's also this nostalgia element of foods that were eaten during the Great Depression. Apparently that is also a factor. I had no idea. I can definitely see why someone would want to cook and bake as a way to unplug. And I think that cooking and baking are ways to sort of get away from your phone and get away from your screen and just do something for yourself. I definitely don't see baking bread as something easy. So I think it's way too much work and very stressful, specifically sourdough bread. Like, you have to maintain that thing. It's going to live in your fridge forever, but you got to feed it. but it's also, you know, comfort food. It's having that extra time. It's boredom. I think now that, you know, a year in, we're all still cooking and like washing those dishes after we cook. So I think we have a different, like, we have a different idea of it now. I think beginning there was a lot of stress and there was a lot of uncertainty. And I think that, well, now it's known that cooking and baking is a way not only to pass the time, but it's also a way to feel control. It's something that you can do and know what the result is going to be. So I think a lot of people in uncertain times look to find control in their lives.
I also spoke with David Santo, who studies food and performance at the University of Ottawa.
Sure. My name is David Santo. And I am right now, I'm doing a bunch of different things in food studies in the world. I'm a part-time teacher at University of Ottawa. I'm doing some research for the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems. I'm also co-editing an open educational resource that is an online open access textbook called Food Studies, Matter, Meaning, and Movement.
David, like Daniela, pointed out that people are investing more time in recreating a food trend they see online because they want to have that feeling of purpose, which is so often absent when you're confined to your home without much to do.
You know, in the same way that people started buying new puppies, people started getting into these things that could be done at home that involved a lot of time, because many of us, again, have a lot of time on our hands. That was a nurturing relationship. So anything to do with a live ferment became pretty exciting because you had to pay attention to it. And while we weren't being able to pay attention to our outside worlds, it gave us something really interesting and also delicious to focus on in the inside world. At the same time, it often gave people who had never done much fermenting or bread making or any of the other basic-ish home kitchen type activities, it gave them pleasure and a new experience during a time when new experiences were pretty rare.
This conversation wouldn't be complete without some food influencers. So I spoke with Montreal-based writer and market strategist Victor Yu, who runs the account at Random Cuisine on Instagram.
I'm Victor, referred to he, him. I actually have different careers. So my main job, I'm a digital and social media strategist. I'm also a content creator for my own Instagram. And then I also write, I'm also a food blogger for Montreal with an extra L. And also I have my own magazine. So I'm a magazine food editor for Bombao Mag. And also I'm a food tour guide of Chinatown.
Victor pointed out again how we've seen the impact of pandemic food trends on the world outside of social media.
Yeah, and I could even tell you, like when people make their own bread, like the sales of bread makers was one shoot up like over 3,000%, just crazy, the beginning of the pandemic. Or even the sugar sales like went over like 1,000%. I mean, I could see on my end because I'm a digital analysis. So I could see how often people visit our website. So yeah, I could tell you like over 1,000% actually went to our website. And I think our client was very happy when they saw that. So also like even the uses of Pinterest has been booming. It's just crazy. I can tell you these are like numbers I see on my end. It's just like people are spending way more time on social media. Even like watching our stories, I can tell you I never actually reach over 2,500 views in a IG story. Usually I get on average 1,000. But yeah, people are spending way more time just to find inspiration. I think that's what it is that the fact that you're confined, you're actually bored and you actually want to find like some sort of like glimmer of hope through all this boring stuff, boring content, and then you find like something super interesting, you just go for it because like it's very accessible because it's either a pantry ingredient. Actually, like the big feta is a very good example where feta, tomato, and basil is actually the thing that you could easily buy. And I read that like feta sales got way like sold out, that like people can actually get feta for weeks because like they actually have to reorder them. So, and I think just the reason is like, as long as it's accessible and reachable, you don't really need to go outside. That's actually where people just get to it. So yeah.
But it makes sense that people are having such extreme reactions while wanting to participate in a trend they see online because our social interactions with each other are so limited right now.
Well, I think, so much for those of us who are privileged enough to have high quality internet, good technology in our homes, and we're allowed to stay home and spend time on that technology, the internet and visual stuff has become so important because it is becoming our replacement for all of those lived interpersonal physical relationships that we used to have. And so it's had to fill in for a lot of the day-to-day small activities, small social interactions, small performances that we do, as well as the much bigger ones like having parties or cocktail hours or interacting with friends and family for more serious stuff. So everything has gotten heightened about what we get to have access to online. And with trends, and again, that sense of connectivity in a time when we're deeply disconnected from each other, I think trends have become ever more important.
When we come back from the break, we'll be discussing the history of food trends online that established a certain level of criteria that makes some of those trends so successful. CGLO, 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. Today, we're looking at food trends on social media. And before the break, we talked about how our relationship with food trends has been impacted by the pandemic. But how do we define a trend, in big air quotes, on social media? And what makes for a successful trend online? I spoke with Concordia PhD candidate Jake Petrie to find out more.
So my name is Jake Petrie, he, him. Are my pronouns. And so I'm a PhD student in film and moving image studies at Concordia. And I study social media platforms and basically how different tech companies kind of tell stories about what they do and how they are planning for the future, basically. And how they build themselves up in the culture as providing a certain service for us. And how we might complicate or problematize those things.
If we're going to contemplate what makes something a trend, the conversation could snowball pretty quickly. So here's the very helpfully concise definition that Jake came to from his studies.
To simplify, I mean, I think a social media trend is basically anything that comes to be shared and repeated ad nauseum online. So it's not quite the same as, you know, something going viral, but often when something does go viral, it becomes a trend as other people post their own versions or interpretations. So, you know, for example, on TikTok, someone might post a certain dance set to a certain song, it goes viral, and everyone starts learning the dance and posting it.
Again, the world of the internet is vaster than the ocean, so it would be difficult to find a start point online where we started to interact with things and call them trends. It can be seen as a natural translation of human desire to want to relate and socialize with the other people in your community circle. Jake said that the beginning of the internet had less organization than the one we think of now, but we could start to see the concept of a trend become standardized with the advent of viral videos on YouTube.
You know, I'd say like our modern understanding of a social media trend probably began with YouTube when it launched in 2006, you know, because suddenly people were able to upload themselves, respond to other people, create content that could very quickly, you know, spread around the internet. But you could also certainly go back to earlier, like internet forums and things like that, where memes and other things would kind of operate similarly. But yeah, I would kind of pinpoint YouTube as like the point where this kind of shift happened in our online experience of how things really become a trend.
Words and text and speech can obviously go viral, but it's not as likely or as appealing as a trend that has a visual aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I think... The visual is everything now, right? So I think it doesn't start with YouTube, but that's where I feel like it transformed into a real like cultural phenomenon where, you know, our previous associations with text and things like that online taking off in certain ways was now becoming something much more image-based and much more much easier really to start spreading really quickly.
And leads up to where we are today with the dominance of apps like Instagram and TikTok.
I think TikTok is a good example too, because it's managed to, you know, quite quickly become really an essential platform, you know, especially for Gen Z or whatever. And its algorithmic structure also seems to lend itself particularly to the proliferation of trends in a way that I think is more acute than any previous platform in a way. So, you know, the attributes obviously also change based on which app you're talking about. So to keep with the same example, like on TikTok, it could be what sound or song you choose to pair with your video. It could be, you know, your skill with the app's effects and editing features. It could be just, you know, capturing some ineffable moment in your life that happens to resonate with people. So it's, you know, it's difficult to pinpoint exactly what is going to make for something to be successful, but then you also have to consider the other side of it, which is what the algorithm prioritizes, because it can send whatever it wants to people's feeds, and especially on TikTok, where you don't have to follow people to get it in your feed. It can send whatever it wants to you, so you kind of have to think about it as a two-pronged system, I guess.
So, trends online need to be visually appealing, and they need to connect us to something outside of ourselves for them to really catch on. So how does this all apply to food? I talked to Gigi LeBlanc, who runs the Instagram account gigi.in.mtl, to see how she defined a food trend.
So my name is Ghislaine LeBlanc, and my pronoun is she. And my title, well, I'm a food photographer. I have an Instagram page, and I'm also a production supervisor in the food industry.
On top of our themes of visual appeal and social interaction, Gigi also added the idea of accessibility to what makes for a successful food trend.
Something that we see several times on social medias in a short period of time. So for me, that would be the trigger. It could be a picture, it could be a video, just something that is easy to make or easy to buy, accessible, that you see a lot in a short amount of time. That would be a food trend for me. On my side, I think that it's more of a sense of community, and the more you do it, the more you feel like you're part of the experience. You're also curious. I think curiosity is a big part of what makes someone want to try a food trend. I just think it's cool to try. Usually it's like short steps, easy things to do, and it's accessible, usually with ingredients or restaurants that are not expensive. Usually it's more like what's popular on social media, and I just think that it's a more of a curious thing to do than other specifications.
Victor also supported the idea that social media trends need to have a community element and reiterated Daniela's connection to the idea of FOMO.
Yeah, so on my end, I see it like it is definitely a sense of community because like once you see it, one person do it, you want to be part of it. And also like something simple to do, like if they say like, oh, my friend could do it, I could do it. But also I feel like, I think from what I previously answered is also there's this effect of FOMO, the fear of missing out. So when other cities or other countries already have that trend, then like when it finally arrives, like, okay, I finally could touch it.
Daniela saw it again with these three themes: visuals, community, and accessibility.
So I think I would define it as a trending topic, so or as the widespread change of shift or shift in focus from like one food to another, from one recipe to another. And I think food trends on Instagram and TikTok happen because of the appeal that they have. So it's primarily visual, specifically on Instagram, right? Because it's normally like a photograph. Now we have reels, but it started off being a photograph. And then there's also like the tactile part with the ASMR trends, but it also has this appeal to participate. So participate with like a certain group, join in on the fun, or replicate what your social group is doing. So that also depends on what you're talking about. And what I mean about like replicating what your social group is doing is if we look at something like health and wellness culture, you know, there are food trends out there that are based on what diet you're following. And actually one of the most viral foods of the past year was a keto food trend, which was the bell peppers with cream cheese because it's a keto snack. So I don't know.
David also pointed out that while food trends online do tend to be about community, since the way we interact with trends is so personal and the trends that are presented to us on our own feeds is different from what someone else is seeing based on what an app algorithm knows about us, the definition of a trend or what someone sees as a trend might vary from person to person.
It seems to me like, well, now as ever, trends have been extremely varied. And of course, if you speak to one person in one community, they might say, oh, that's not a trend. And another one will say, oh, it's absolutely the only thing that's happening right now. And so trending, which can now be measured so effectively through social media, has become a sort of different thing than the trends were that I grew up with, for example, like the hula hoop. But you know, those are different kinds of trends. I think right now on social media, we're seeing a lot of very visual trends. Certainly in terms of things like the way that food is plated and arranged, but there are a lot of what would be maybe more performance-like trends, and certainly TikTok is a great example of people taking a gesture or movement or a combination of movement and sound, music, and remixing them in some ways to kind of replicate the trend, but also add to it. So I think that's what's sort of wonderful about social media trends is that they're more remixable in some ways than historic trends that didn't appear as much or weren't as driven quite as much by media. But I do think, you know, depending on your community, depending on whether you're more of an Instagram still photo kind of person or a TikTok motion and movement person, you will define trend differently. So I wouldn't say that there's any one kind of trend and they're super heterogeneous. And of course, as we know with social media, the more you remain within your, well, the more the algorithm keeps you within your particular bubble of information and knowledge and visuals, the more you think that that is the one trend that's going on. Whereas, of course, if you step out of it or if you speak to someone else, they'll be in a whole different circle of exchange and communications and the appearance of trends.
While we can draw social media trends back to YouTube and memes and early internet forums, food trends can actually draw their start date back to before the internet. David explained how we could also historically look at food trends as they appeared in print.
I was thinking about, you know, before the internet, and because in sort of as I was thinking about preparing for this conversation, I was wondering, yeah, what were some of the food trends sort of pre-internet? But they've always been related to media in some way. So I think that's where That's the common element, because of course, a thing that's happening in one place doesn't get known about in other places unless it's transmitted through some sort of, mediated communication system. And so the food trends that would have been happening, say, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, things like nouvelle cuisine, and then eventually the emergence of things like molecular gastronomy, even before the internet, were becoming known through largely print media and sometimes television media. Television treating food culture a little bit less seriously in the 70s, for example, but then catching up certainly by now, and where it's become one of the number one subjects. But so journalism and written words were really the origin of that, that dissemination of new things that were happening that apparently were going to catch on eventually. So I think now with digital media, where really the visual is a much stronger component than in, of course, print journalism, which is still obviously visual, but it's textual, not graphic. We see things like the verticality of a dish becoming a trend. So there was a whole period, I don't even want to name when it was, but I'm imagining it. It feels to me like it was end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, where plates had to have vertical appeal. You know, things had to be stacked up on top of each other, or there had to be sprigs of herbs going vertically out of the flat piece of steak. And so that verticality was very much attached to the visuality of Instagram. Of course, Instagram drove all sorts of changes in terms of digital photography and camera settings. This is back when we were actually using cameras to photograph our food for the internet, not using phones. And so all of these things were certainly at play.
So there were outlets to consume food as a mediated experience before the internet, and those mediated food experiences created a kind of push and pull effect, where the presentation of food in media influences how food is presented to you at a restaurant or how you prepare it in your home. And then that presentation is photographed or written about and is given to the consumer anew, and the cycle continues. After the advent of the internet, but before social media came to dominate the online landscape as it does now, Daniello pointed out that many people were using food blogs as a way of sharing their food experiences online.
I would say it comes from blogging. You know, there are people who are interested in having different types of blogs, and I think that food blogs are one of those popular blog trends. And then these food bloggers migrated to social media once social media apps started appearing. And then I think it also comes from those blogs and from the now hashtag, which is food porn. Before it, on those blogs, it used to be sort of this voyeuristic practice of publicly sharing still or video images of foods, but also to sort of entice and deliver foods somewhere else. Maybe you can't go to where those foods are, but you can look at them. And I think, well, those are the origins of that hashtag.
And Victor had to remind me that before we got to the whipped coffee and feta pasta, the BuzzFeed channel Tasty set the standard for quick videos on how to recreate an easily accessible recipe.
Yeah, so I see it in a way that, like, the reason why these videos are doing so well, the TikTok videos, part of it has to do with Tasty. I'm sure you guys remember Facebook keeps shoving us with Tasty videos because they have, like, this overhead shot and everything is done within 30 to 1 minute. I forgot how long these videos used to be. And I think the fact that we've been shoved by Facebook that these are these accessible videos, that's actually how TikToks are doing super well, because, like, they're quick. And also, you don't really need to do research. You don't actually need to watch Gordon Ramsay cook, like, a certain quick meal for 15 minutes, but they could do it in 30 seconds. So, and at the end, like, you just need to know the gist of how the recipe works. And then at some point, you become creative.
So again, visually appealing and accessible. And with the introduction of Tasty, we start to see the new theme of education, something that teaches you how to make a recipe, which we see now proliferated on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. These criteria do have an impact on the way we interact with food in real life, even if it's just influencing the way you prepare a meal at home because you saw a new technique in a video that showed up on your feed.
If I speak about my personal experience, it's sure that when I see some recipes on social medias that really interest me and I try them, it allows me to learn like different techniques. Sometimes you can find a lot of different tips or advices on TikTok, like how to cut this, how to cook this. So I think it allowed me to learn more about how to be a better cook, because I'm not someone that cooks a lot. So I find that the format on TikTok or Instagram is fast. So usually it's like 30 seconds. I'm not sure for TikTok. I'm not on TikTok, but I don't watch a lot of them. But it's a fast way to learn things, and it's pretty straightforward. It's direct. You don't have to like go do research. Like it's straight into your face. So I think it's a great way to learn in a short amount of time. So that's how it helped me being a better cook.
If you're online and interacting with these food trends, you've probably noticed how some of the elements have become formalized, how so many trendy food fads need to be visual and accessible and educational. Again, think about that bright green, red, and white of the feta pasta trend and how easy it was to pop it into your oven and feel like an accomplished chef. So, how does interacting with food trends online, something which is at its core pretty formulaic, affect the way we consume food in real life? Here's what David had to say.
Well, like any mediated experience, particularly a mediated experience that's been filtered, cropped, edited, and polished, we are developing expectations for our food that are generally a lot higher than what is realizable in the day-to-day. That's the great critique of food porn, is that it creates these unrealistic expectations based on a distanciated experience of food that is not only distanciated, but edited, that's been turned into something that never truly existed in the first place, that doesn't exist in the real world. And one of the things that makes food delightful is that it is imperfect constantly, and it's always changing. And that even if you practice a recipe 25 times or 150 times, it'll always be different. Every single moment of the making is different because it's a performance. A performance is never replicable perfectly from one moment to the next. And that's what makes food so cool. Like, we don't want it to be standardized. Even in the great myth is that every McDonald's hamburger tastes the same around the world. And of course it doesn't. Every McDonald's hamburger is completely different from the previous one, both that you have eaten and that your friend has eaten and that everybody else around the world has eaten, not just because of the ingredients and the way that it's made, but because the act of eating is itself a performance. And so that becomes different each time.
Social media is a highly sanitized, performative platform. Of course, there are exceptions to this, but very rarely are people posting and sharing their most disgusting or complicated or embarrassing moments. That wouldn't be very visually appealing or accessible. And while your friends sharing their replication of feta pasta or whipped coffee most likely don't have social media teams designing each post, there are definitely accounts out there that do. And when those accounts make a post, it's meant to pull you in. They want you to interact with it.
I want to go back to the visual appeal. I don't know if it's part of like my artist side, but I definitely think that people put a lot of thought into not only the food that they're making, but making food pretty is also a huge job. Like all of those food photos that you see everywhere, there's a food stylist behind it. There's a set behind it. You know, there's a photographer. And there's like tips and tricks on like how to make food more appealing. It's not only like the colors, but it's also the plating. And, you know, there's a lot of psychological and like marketing that goes behind that. So I think that if you try to hit all those check marks and it tastes good, because I think that if people do this and they're like, this tastes horrible, then it won't be a trend. Or maybe it will and just be the worst tasting food trend ever. So that's why I think there are some that like check all the boxes, and then there are some where I'm just like, it just happened.
So there's usually a human on the other end of some of those more perfectly framed posts attempting to make you desire to be a part of the food trend. But something we haven't really touched on a lot yet is the idea of apps algorithms and how using an app is designed to keep you interacting with it. How it monitors what kinds of posts you interact with the most and then sends you more of those posts to the top of your feed so you stay online.
TikTok and Instagram have an interest, like all platforms do, in ensuring their own growth and also ensuring that people spend as much time as possible on their platform, looking at ads, engaging with whatever they're trying to offer up to you, which means that they're going to constantly be developing strategies to do that. And this can come out in many different ways. It can be, introducing new features, like when Instagram introduces Reels, which is kind of their response to TikTok, basically. It's kind of, their response to TikTok success. And, you know, what Instagram does when they introduce Reels is start paying influencers from TikTok to switch over to Reels. And so that's not an algorithmic kind of, response, but it's part of the strategy that platforms will do to keep you on them. And their algorithms operate in a way where they're going to show you what they believe is personalized content to you, stuff that you want to see. And, you know, whether or not it's true, it might be every third or fourth or fifth thing that it shows you that you actually like, but that, you know, dopamine hit or whatever is going to keep you scrolling anyway. And so, you know, the algorithm is trained to do that as well as it can, and it learns from you the longer you spend on it. So it's just kind of this, you know, vicious circle, I guess, of the more time you spend on it, the better it gets at knowing you and the better it gets at sending you the thing that it thinks you're going to want to like.
Here's Daniela talking about how the algorithm on Instagram influences what posts she sees.
Well, I mean, right now, definitely it's catered to what you're clicking and what you're liking and what you're saving. So I, for example, since I'm studying food and I began interacting with these accounts, I get a lot of tangents of food. So I'm getting a lot of health and wellness nutritionists who are doing a lot of food content, sort of giving you nutrition facts. And that's definitely something that I'm not interested in. But it comes with that path, right? It's like, oh, okay, so you have followed all of these food accounts and have liked and saved all of this food content. Why don't you go down this path? And also, I mean, it probably comes down to not only what I'm interacting with in terms of what I'm studying, it's also, you know, my age and where I live and probably my past interests. So I think in terms of algorithms, like if it is a trending topic, you're going to get it and you're going to see it. It's not a coincidence that everyone knows that Dalgona coffee was a trend last year.
The algorithms on social media platforms aren't operating on their own yet. They still need human content creators. But, Gigi said, it will certainly prioritize the ones that are already the most successful.
Yeah, well, I think that if someone's very popular on TikTok or Instagram will start a trend, it's going to be easier for them to set the trend because they're already advantaged by the algorithm. So I think that's the main factor. I don't think that algorithms are manipulating food trends. I just think that it depends on who posts something, and you never know in advance what's going to be viral. So I think it's just a matter of circumstances. I don't think it has an influence. That's my opinion.
And so, we haven't yet become completely beholden to these algorithms. Humans as content creators and content consumers still seem to have a say in what becomes successful. Victor pointed out how rare it is for there to be a food trend of something that doesn't taste good or look good because people don't want to eat that.
So what I'm seeing is, I don't think it's a question of algorithm. Well, I actually have a science background. So I see it as like when you follow certain influencers or like someone who has like high number of followers and you're basically kind of expecting good content after good content. So they're actually influencing you with whatever they're doing, whatever food trends they're doing. So then you just gonna pick up. But I have a feeling it's a bit like the stock market in a way, like the stock market is actually highly influenced by media. Whether they say in the newspaper or on TV, they say like, oh, Apple is doing so bad, then people will start selling it just because of that kind of statement. And I feel like that's how basically sort of influencers or basically, well, they are actually influence them so that like to give them a direction or a purpose. I think that's actually how I see it, because I think Gigi and I, we also have a purpose of like educating our followers and like what's actually really good food compared to like there's other Instagrammers where they just publish just because they got free food and they say, oh, that's really good, but when you try it, but it might not be very good. So in a way, us, we do have a responsibility with our followers and like what we're influencing them, right?
While algorithms are evolving and obviously have an effect on what trends tend to go viral, humans still have a say in what their content consumption is going to look like. Jake talked about how some communities on the internet are trying to create alternative platforms for sharing things online as a way to resist algorithms' sway over their consumption.
We're already living in these utopias of their design, even if they're like unwanted utopias for us. And so I think, you know, increasingly, I think users are feeling a little stifled by this system. And so we're seeing more examples of, you know, digital public platforms and infrastructures being built. The classic one would be like an open source platform like Mastodon. But then there's also things like driver-led ride-sharing cooperatives that are trying to, you know, provide a fairer service than Uber, for example. And I think it's really tough to compete. And I think especially when your opponents are in social media, which are these massive conglomerations like Facebook and TikTok. But I think there are ways that already exist for users to co-opt these algorithms to put forward content that the platforms may not necessarily like. And I think there are ways to build alternatives that we're starting to see. It's just gonna take, you know, a lot of collective power to make it actually stick.
So again, algorithms obviously have their influence, but there are still ways for people to build communities online, separate from what the algorithm of an app might be throwing at them. When we come back from the break, we'll be looking at the online food community in Montreal and how food trends can be used to spread awareness about social and political issues. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Where would we be if we couldn't tweet our thoughts? You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. In the previous two segments, we looked at how we've latched on to food trends online more because of the pandemic, and how the history of social media trends and marketing techniques and algorithms can affect the way we interact with food online. Again, algorithms and marketing techniques can have an influence over what becomes a trend. But the symbiotic relationship between social media platforms and their users means that content creators and consumers also have a say in what will become popular. For example, trends can become very localized, and part of that is the algorithm being able to tell where you're located. But the food and culture of a particular city outside of its social media universe can influence what will become a trend in a particular place. Here's some trends Victor and Gigi were able to recount from the last year that were specific to Montreal.
I don't know, Victor, if you've seen like maybe the ice cream, like people were doing ice cream crawls during summer. I don't know if it's something that people do in Toronto, but last summer it was like ice cream everywhere. Just from Montreal or else the fried chicken. I think we spoke about it, Victor, yesterday, but we've seen so many fried chicken business opening last year and then the beginning of the year, and we're still wondering why. Is it because the chickens are less expensive? I don't know, but it's just everywhere.
Yeah,
because the nations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and part of it is the chicken is actually easy to prepare. Like I could tell you, like this restaurant called Vaimont Lapin, they actually have this sort of what do I call it? Ghost Kitchen, maybe. Casgrain barbecue. And they actually marinate their chicken in sourdough bread because like sourdough acts like buttermilk. And they actually also use the sourdough as their batter. And then it becomes like you're eating a sourdough bread crusted in the fried chicken. It's actually one of their juiciest fried chicken. I really love it. So,
one of the other trends they talked about becoming popular online was pictures of picnic basket arrangements, which had the external influence of the pandemic driving more people to eat outside and became a localized trend in Montreal because of its relatively high volume of parks.
And maybe another trend would be like during last summer, all the picnics, because we were at some point we weren't allowed to see each other in closed areas. So picnics, like I've never done that much picnic in my life. Every week there was at least one picnic. So I think that's it was a big trend that we've seen on Instagram last summer. So, yeah.
I think we're quite lucky in Montreal. I would say maybe picnic could be like even like a Montreal thing because we're so lucky to have lots of greens. Especially like we have canals, we have so many parks. I could tell you in Toronto, like because my company is in Toronto, like I walk for hours and I've probably seen like two parks, but they're not very well maintained compared to like Montreal parks where they're so well maintained that like you just like picnic whenever you feel like doing. And yeah, actually that's the other trend that has been popping out, like picnic boxes by like a lot of businesses, right? Well, one of the first ones has been known for years is Dine at Triple Crown, where like because like their business is just next to a park, and then I think like a lot of business got inspired from them and like okay, people could just like order a picnic box, like, or at least like a set so that they could eat with their friends. So I think that's actually one of the things that kind of unique to Montreal, I would say.
When it comes to localized online food communities, Gigi and Victor said they found Montreal to be unique because of how tight-knit it is.
And I think that it just brings a good sense of community. Like the foodies in Montreal or chefs, we all know each other. It's a big community. It's like we're, I guess, more than 100 people. So I think that it creates real connection in real life. So that's something else that we can from all these trends and all these posts we see on Instagram. It allows, like, it starts a discussion and then we can create like friendships like that.
Yeah, and I think that's why our foodie community is so tight, because we have many common friends together because we see each other at events. But also I think we're quite lucky in Montreal that we're so small, our community, compared to Toronto, where like I could tell you there's so many communities of foodies, but then they have their own cliques. But like ours, we are very tight. So
they seem to credit this to Montreal's emphasis on locally owned small restaurants instead of bigger chains, and also noted that since their community is so small, creators don't seem to be encroaching on each other's content.
Yeah, I think that too. We have so many restaurants in Montreal, and we have a category of Instagram that is really local because all the restaurants are local. You cannot go from another country. Well, one day maybe, but I mean, all our collaborations are with local businesses, local chefs. So we have a lot of restaurants in Montreal. We have a lot of people making food at home now. So talking about a food trend, there's a lot of companies doing their business at home now. So there's so many people to cover that we're a small community and everyone has its niche. Specialization, like Victoria is more focused on Asian food. We'll be more focused on the artistic side of food. So we all have our different particularities, and that's what makes the community really like tight and not competitive, because we're all different and we all focus on different aspects of the food industry in Montreal.
They even seemed to believe there were more niches to fill, and that they felt like some parts of the food landscape in Montreal weren't being covered by food influencers.
In a way, I do want to have a bit more foodies. Like, I feel I'm still the only one who covers Asian cuisine in Montreal, and I wish there were more people so that like people know more about Asian cuisine. So, yeah, I mean, especially like Brossard and Vis and Aran, where there's so many like good Asian restaurants, but I don't actually live. It's very far from there. So, if there was a food blogger, a foodie, or Instagrammer that lives there, talk about these places, that would be great. But for just one person, it's kind of hard to cover as much. And I also have a full-time job, so
Trends and shared content are a way of connecting with the world outside of ourselves. And with the isolation that comes with the pandemic, this act has become more important to us. Daniela is studying particularly how we share food trends during the pandemic. And she talked about how people have been building food communities online and how restaurants have been using their social media platforms for outreach and aid.
Yeah, In many ways, I think that food trends and food content can help build a sense of community. I think food has always been about sharing and about expression, and it hits like various chords. You know, there's like the sense part, then there's like emotions, there's intrigue, there's exploration. So that in itself builds, you know, it's like a foundation for people who enjoy food. That's probably a larger portion or like a huge community. But as for like the alienation part, I think yes and no. It depends on who you're talking to and also how they use social media, because social media is also about sharing, right? But you're not really sharing everything. You see what people decide to share. Some people are sharing things in a very calculated way, in a very performative way. So it really depends on who you talk to. But I think, I mean, in terms of food, imagine just being stuck at home and probably being by yourself, isolated by yourself, and then having this community where you can do activities and like feel like part of a bigger thing. And then, I mean, during this past year, so many restaurants have had to shut down and close down. And then the ones who decided not to, or the ones who decided to reopen, have probably had to adapt and will probably continue to adapt during this next year and or during this year. And I think that a lot of restaurants are also thinking about the people that used to come into their restaurants or the people that work for them. And maybe the people that used to come into the restaurants will never be able to come into the restaurants.
And people have been using these platforms as a way to spread awareness and raise funds around political issues, many of which touch on some of the systemic problems which already plague the food industry.
What I've seen through the accounts that I follow is people speaking out against racism, fundraising for Black Lives Matter, speaking out against cultural appropriation, and mainly speaking out about the prevailing whiteness in the food industry. So it's not really tied to a specific food trend. It's more white chefs being racist. So cooking food and saying it's authentic and then not having any respect for what that cuisine or the culture that they're taking from wants or thinks about this. We're not studying enough, not even acknowledging that the food that they've made comes from a specific culture.
So when you look at a food trend online, yes, there is a person or an algorithm that's trying to get you to engage with it. But as a consumer, you still have the power to decide what gets interacted with. And people can still create content that makes a point or shares a trend that people in your community circle might not have been aware of before.
So I think there's a lot of ways of building up the community, of maintaining your community. And they can be as small or as big as you want them to. It really depends on the reach. And I think that social media has been a great way to not only let people know what you're doing, but also probably inspire them to do the same thing in their own neighborhood, in their own country, now that we can see things from far away and that we're all connected.
Thank you for listening to The Squeaky Curd. Today's episode wouldn't have been possible without the participation of Daniela Silva, David Santo, Victor Yu, Gigi LeBlanc, and Jake Petrie. You can learn more about David's work at davidsanto.com. look up Jake's work at jakeadampetrie.com. And check out Gigi and Victor's Instagram pages at gigi.in.mtl and at Random Cuisine. Our show illustration and logo were designed by Christina Rivera. Please join us next time as we look at the state of restaurant food delivery during the pandemic and with the curfew in Montreal. From Gwen Rowley, you're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal.